Space Cowboy Books presents Simultaneous Times, a science and speculative fiction podcast. Short stories to stir the imagination by contemporary authors.
The Sport of Snails by F.J. Bergman, with music by Fog Machine. Read by Jean-Paul Garnier. Riding a racing snail on land was almost pointless. Sure, they were smooth, but they didn't move any faster than a fit youth like Esef could ambulate. And if you tried to sniff anything fun and ride, the shell was so slick you'd slide off as soon as you lost your balance even a little bit. Also, on land, snails had to be parked once you arrived at your destination. And due to the slime accumulation, snail parking lots tended to be far away and downwind. Some of Esef's peers had outfitted their snails with grips, harnesses, headrests, and other extras. But Esef's parent group didn't believe in desecrating any divinely created being by drilling into it or marking it. Which meant no piercings, implants, or cool tattoos. Not even the fake ones. For her, either. Besides, her secondary father rode Artog to his job every day and refused to have anything fancy. "My workmates will think I'm getting above myself," he'd said, his eyes bulging. "Or that I'm taking bribes. We can't have that." Artog stays exactly as the provider made him. And that was the end of the discussion. Esef had experimented with sticky coatings, but since the whole point was to ride somewhere and arrive in style, any success was overshadowed by the downside of ending up with goop all over her clothes. To say nothing of the unfortunate discovery that her particular brand of glue was apparently a snail aphrodisiac. Artog had suddenly become very attractive indeed to other snails, and only a tussle, whether amorous or contentious she had been unable to determine, between the first two arrivals had prevented a forcible mating and subsequent ineligibility for the racing season. While the snails were hermaphroditic, long-standing tradition and impressive, though detachable, penises had resulted in all snails being denoted with masculine pronouns. Riding her snail underwater, however, was an amazing experience. In water, a net could be stretched around the snail's foot in order to attach a rider. A net wasn't possible on land because of friction, and not needed at a snail's minuscule terrestrial velocity. But in the ocean, there was almost no interference with the basal undulation that resulted in exhilarating aquatic speed. Thank the provider that Esef's parents were on board with what they called making the most of divine gifts. In other words, racing, albeit with the unenhanced capabilities of both Esef and Artog. Enhancements for racing would have consisted of water foils, friction-reducing shell polish, and vitamin supplements at the very least. All anathema to the parent group. Esef took Artog out for training sprints as often as possible. Artog wasn't the most highly bred snail, but he was spirited and athletic. Esef had an unpleasant suspicion, though, that training might not be enough to overcome Artog's admittedly inferior genetics. And it wasn't just Artog she wanted to win with. If she could get a few wins with Artog, she'd be able to get gigs riding other snails. And if those won... The top racing snail stables paid their jockeys fabulous wages, so she'd heard. And best of all, those stables were based a long, long way from her parent group. As soon as she had the cash, she'd get iridium shoulder studs and skull flaps. And whatever Artog wanted for himself, of course. The day of the race dawned dark and stormy. Heavy winds roiled the waves into pale foam. Esef slipped into the fluorescent silk suit, put on her goggles, and slithered into the net holds, giving Artog an encouraging pat. Just get out in front as early as you can, buddy. No matter what it takes. I've got a little surprise. He twitched an eye stalk in reply. She checked the small pouch secreted in her chest groove. I hope this works, she thought. Various performance-enhancing stimulants were banned and tested for, and poisoning one's competition resulted in severe penalties. But distracting them with a naturally generated aphrodisiac was not covered by any rules she'd been able to look up. Of course, stout denial would be the safest strategy. The snails in Artog's division, maiden eight-year-olds, lined up along an underwater cliff, waiting for the starter signal's weight to plunge downward. They would swim out into the bay, pass to the outward side of a small island, and return to land through a channel too narrow for more than one snail at a time, leaving no doubt as to the order of finishing. Then she saw a descending stream of bright bubbles. Go, Artog, she shouted, whacking his shell. Artog surged forward with a powerful thrust of his foot, then began smoothly rippling through the water. This deep, the waves above were barely noticeable, although they might change when the currents caught them offshore. Artog was doing his best. He showed no sign of flagging, but she had to face it. He just wasn't as fast as a top-notch racing snail, which his rivals in this race obviously were. They were approaching the island, hugging the rocky shore as closely as possible despite the strong current. But Artog hadn't been able to get far enough ahead for her to dump the solution of aphrodisiac glue. All for nothing, she thought, despairingly. And the current will be even stronger past the island. Except, it occurred to her, the tide will be running the other way. If we go wide just as I release the glue and then drop speed, the current will carry it to all the snails in front of Artog. If it works, it won't matter if we slow down. If it doesn't work, we're screwed anyway. Artog, she hissed, tapping his shell. His response was to swim more energetically. Artog, turn outward. She yanked the net sideways to signal him and pounded on the shell vigorously. He bent one eye stalk and then the other backward to stare at her. She pointed outward, miming the dumping while watching the other riders. But all of them were focused on their immediate competition. They'd written her off already. We'll see about that. The aphrodisiac was certainly effective. There was no doubt about that. Artog was able to make a leisurely loop and pass the rest of the snails. And he was the first one through the finish passage. Of course, she had cheated to win, but considering her and Artog's lack of enhancements, it seemed only fair. But where were the other snails? Once Artog had slimed out of the water and made his way to the top of the cliff, they had an excellent view of the course. What SF hadn't known was that the other riders were also cheating, in a way that she considered to be a whole other level of unethical. They'd acquired electric prods to stimulate their snails to greater efforts, and the interaction with the glue's effects had been interesting. As she and a large number of sports fans and officials looked on, the remaining snails rampaged in a spectacle melee. Occasionally, one would actually go airborne, either from being rammed too enthusiastically by another, or due to an especially powerful basal flick or ripple from the snail itself, the jockeys desperately anchoring themselves to what remained of the nets. The spectators were riveted. Normally, nothing could be seen of the race except the departure, if the water was sufficiently clear, and the snails exiting at the end of the race, unless one was unfortunate enough to be swept up onto the island rocks. But this was taking place at the surface, or in some cases, above it. As a snail sport, it certainly beat racing. Upon reflection, SF abandoned her dreams of being a top snail jockey. It shouldn't be difficult, after today, to to find investors for a very large and well-lit glass-sided tank in a viewing arena. And she suspected that snail aphrodisiac distribution would subsequently prove far more profitable. Hollow Hearts by Eric Fomley, with music by Fall Precautions, read by Jean-Paul Garnier. Running an AI shop where you recreate dead loved ones is a tough business. I had just opened the shop for the day when a young woman walked in. She glanced around before approaching my counter with her head down. Judging by the mood of the customer, I try to tailor my service to either be direct and respect the difficulty of the situation, informative if they're here for a companion, and reserved with my questions if they seem embarrassed by the ordeal. I thought she would fall in the first column, but when she looked up at me, there was a deep emptiness in her gaze. I had seen a lot of gut-wrenching things over my years, but nothing quite tore out my heart the way this woman's gaze had. "Can I help you?" I asked. She nodded and looked into her purse. Her hand dived inside and rummaged around before producing her phone. "I'm not sure how this works," she said. She clicked the button on the side so the lock screen showed, and flipped it for me to see an image of her with a young man, smiling in front of a sunset on a beach. "I want you to bring him back, but I don't want to take him home. Just temporarily. Can you do that?" I looked from the picture to her. It was a strange request. The generated products were very expensive to make. Oftentimes, it was more than what the average person made in a year, and that was just for the materials. When someone chose not to take the person with them, it was usually because they couldn't emotionally handle it. Never a choice made before walking in. This was a strange request. "I can dispose of the finished product, but I must warn you, the cost is rather high. The materials themselves are expensive, so I don't have a cheaper rate for what you're asking. It would still be the same cost if you brought him home with you." She chewed on her lip for a second, looked down at her phone, nodded. "That's okay. I have enough from his life insurance that I can cover the cost." The empty gaze faltered a little. Tears welled in her lower eyelids. That made the situation odder to me. Was she really going to use all of what he'd left to her for just one temporary moment? It wasn't my place to debate customers. "Very well, step over here," I said. She shared her payment details with me and I came around the corner. I led her to one of the cylindrical vats along the wall. I tapped the screen and the AI welcomed her and prompted her to input information. She stepped forward and synced a series of images and videos from her phone, pouring all the phone contained of whoever this person was into the machine. It analyzed the data. It would do its best to create the likeness of him, complete with not only the look, but the voice and personality as best as it could from the videos. The product would go so far as to have the memories from the media she uploaded to it, and the background information she input, the relationship to her that she said it would have. It would be a very shallow, very dumbed-down version of the man she once knew. I walked back to the counter to respect her privacy. There were no other patrons yet this morning. The day was still so young, commuters were just starting to pass by the shop window, some sparing a glance at me through the glass, probably wondering who they might bring back if they were so inclined or could afford it themselves. I vaguely wondered how many of them I might see someday, bringing me a photograph or an idea for a friend, family member, spouse, or lover. After 15 or 20 minutes, the machine chimed and the screen turned green. The woman looked over at me and back to the vat. She walked over to the glass and peered inside as it began to construct the bones, piecing them together with a special tacky joint glue. I never recommend that people watch the building process. The AI warns of it during its prompting. It creates distance with the finished product and can affect the connection the patron hoped for. The woman didn't seem to mind as she stood there staring with her empty gaze. It's common courtesy to let people do what they need to in my shop. I'm in the business of emotional damage and support. It's rude to pry. But the oddity of this woman compelled me to come around the counter again. "It shouldn't take long now," I said. "These newer model machines do expedient work. When I first opened, I used to have to tell people to come back the next day." She nodded absently. The vat was almost done constructing the black carbon fiber skeleton. It would wire the skeleton with the required circuitry and give it an artificial brain before it was padded with a foam-like substance, and the synth skin would be sprayed with the specified color over the frame. "Who was he?" I asked, and immediately thought better of it. "My husband. He passed away a few weeks ago." "I'm sorry for your loss," I said. The words were vague, cliche, hollow as hollow gets. But what can anyone say when someone shares that they lost the love of their life? She nodded again. I stood by her in silence for a few minutes, watched as the vat finished the wiring and filled the void between the black bones and wires with foam. It would only be another 5 or so minutes before the machine was finished. "It was sudden," she said to the silence between us. "I never expected it to be sudden." I kept my silence. I had done enough, too much. Whatever she said from here would be her own choice to share. I was going about my day like it was any other day. You never think something like this will happen to you. Whenever I thought of losing him, I always had this image in my mind of sometime 60 years down the road when we were both withered and gray, lying in bed together as we passed peacefully from this world to the next. Her voice cracked and her stony expression folded. Tears leaked down her cheeks. She sobbed. She sucked in a few deep breaths and blew the last one out in a long, shuddering breath. I was at work when it happened. We'd spent the night arguing. Money was tight for us. We were struggling to make ends meet. But it was my birthday and he brought me flowers. Not the cheap department store flowers, but a bouquet from a florist. I was so mad at him. I remember screaming at him, and then was up late crying as I thought of all the hurtful things I'd said to him. He worked earlier than me the next day, and when I woke up, I went to work. Throughout the day, I formulated what I wanted to say. I went to a meeting and my phone started blowing up. I was mad again because I thought it was him, and he knows how much I respect his time at work. And why wasn't he respecting mine? I excused myself from the room, and when I checked my phone, I had a missed call from him, and several more from the police department. I called the police back first. He'd been in an accident. Fatal. The final word hung between us, sent a chill down my spine. I was so numb, I tried calling him back. Over and over, I'd hear his voice on his voicemail. When I went downtown, the officers told me the accident was so severe that he was killed instantly. That he never felt any pain, like that was supposed to help. But I didn't tell them he'd called me, that I'd missed his call. He was alive, even if it was only for a few moments before the police showed up. He was alive and I never answered. Never got to comfort him in those final moments. It was too sudden. She lifted her hand to her face, covered her mouth as she wept and looked through the glass, to the finished product of her husband, standing naked in the vat before her. "You can still take him with you if you want," I said. My chest was tight. A stone formed in my throat. "You paid for the recreation. It's yours. I know it will never replace him, but some people say it helps." I knew it was a lie. I remembered the creation I'd made for myself when I lost my wife. It never helped me. She shook her head and her hand dove into her purse again. She pulled out a folded paper and took a step towards the recreation. "Hello, Anya," the AI said in a hushed and loving tone. The vat hissed open, and she rushed forward and gave it a hug. A tight embrace I'd seen so many times over the years. But when she pulled away, she pushed the piece of paper in its hand and walked out of my shop. She didn't spare a glance, a moment, or another word. I kept the AI around the rest of the day, but something in the pit of my stomach told me I'd never see her again. Her grief was too great. The soreness of her loss was rooted as deep as the roots of any loving spouse's. Too deep to be dug out by some facade. I took the note from the creation and unfolded it. "I'm sorry," it read. My chest swelled with grief. When people ask me how I run the shop, how I can deal with this day in and day out, this is why. However, this method of grieving didn't help me. I only hoped, as I looked out the window to the street beyond, that maybe, just maybe, her apology helped her. In this episode of Simultaneous Times, you heard The Sport of Snails by F.J. Bergman, with music by Fog Machine, and Hollow Hearts by Eric Fomley, with music by Fall Precautions. Theme music by Dane Luscombe. Come visit us at our bookstore in Joshua Tree, or online at spacecowboybooks.com. Don't forget to subscribe, and visit us on Instagram and Twitter. We'd love to know what you think of the show.